Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations stance point.
Good morning, you mob, and welcome to Let's Talk Black Sports on Triple A Murray Country. My name is Dr. Lee Shepherd. Most of you know I'm a durable Mullerudji Jabbagai Yurukandji woman from far north Queensland and an anthropologist with expertise in sport for development in Aboriginal Australia. Before I start today's interview, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land upon
which we're currently broadcasting
on the Triple A Murray and Yagara Nations and pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging. Today is part two, and we are talking again with our special guest, Heredia Lumumba. Following on from last week's, we're going to move on to the letter of intent that you recently published, and which I highly recommend you bring it up and have a look. I'll put it up online after the show. Now, it's a pretty powerful, letter where you address, systemic media harm, the legacy of treatment to players like Adam Goods and Willie Rioli, and how these narratives reflect a deeper colonial logic, which we discussed during our last show, that continues to shape the AFL and broader culture. And can you walk us through that letter from start to finish? Because it's really interesting. It's a very powerful message that you put forward.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, and thanks again for having me. Loved chatting with you last show. So I was looking forward to part two. But yeah, the letter, it really came from me being firstly disconnected in many ways from the AFL world. I still do always stay connected through the black players, whether they're Aboriginal or African players in the league and even the Pacifica players. I always have an interest in their careers, and I always did even before I played. Growing up, that's just who I used to follow and watch, and I think that's just a natural thing. So I will always look for highlights. I'll always look at stats specifically for those players, and whenever we're in the media, I always look to see how we're represented. And that's really the only way that I've stayed connected. And I do have a connection with some players as well, just through social media. Like, we'll send each other a note every now and again. But the letter, going back to the letter, where it came from was actually a journalist that reached out to me. Yeah. It was a journalist by the name of John Ralph. He is a prominent AFL media personality now, and he reached out to me just a few weeks ago in the lead up to the 10 year anniversary of Adam Goods's war cry, which was what he did in a game. It was during Indigenous round, and he did a war cry dance that that basically it was received in a really disturbing way by a lot of people within the industry that still doesn't get examined in the way that it should. But basically, I was playing at that time, and when it happened, and I'll never forget, the following day I was playing a game at the TIO Stadium in Alice Springs, and one of my teammates, a proud Noongar man, his name's Jeff Gartlett, he came up to me and he said, "Hey brother, the word got around from the other black players in the league." He said, "Whenever if we score a goal, they want us to either do a shake the leg dance or throw a spear." And they said they specifically asked if you would be a part of it as well. And I was honored, to be included in that. And so the call came out, and this doesn't get reported on. This goes back to what you've dedicated some of your time to research researching is black resistance within sport.
Yeah.
You know? And to me, that was a perfect moment of resistance because we were all watching, glued to our TVs the night before, and we were watching, you know, we're watching because Adam Goods was being booed week after week, week after week. So it was building up this momentum, and it was like almost that moment burst out of him where it was like he had removed all the shackles and said this, and it was the pure expression of a warrior, you know, a proud warrior from the land. And you could see, you like, I get goosebumps thinking of it because you could see the, it's almost like he had transformed into an energy that has existed for tens of thousands of years. It was so powerful, you know? And because of how raw and how authentic and how just moving that was, the way that that was interpreted, going back to what we were talking about in the last show, is that where you're not supposed to express that.
Yeah.
That's what literally Eddie Maguire, who was commentating live at the time, he said, I don't know what that was, but we definitely don't want to see it ever again.
Eddie Maguire's got issues. Anyway.
Yeah, there were former players that had played against Adam Goods, a guy called Jonathan Brown. He was saying, oh, we don't like that. No, they were shook, you know? And when you look at a lot of the backgrounds of some of these commentators, or some of these people that were in the media talking about it, they actually came from places where there were frontier wars, you know, happens, just doesn't happen. So there was all of these historical things that were pulling, that brought this moment together. And I was watching it and I was fuming because I was like, and when I got the call to say, hey, if you score a goal, you're either doing the shake the leg. I hadn't done the shake the leg, actually I'd never really done the shake the leg. So like, look, I don't know. I won't do that, but I'm more than happy to throw a spear or two. Yeah. So I thought, and for me, I play in defense. I was playing in defense, and just the way that it happened, I happened to be in Alice Springs, and in the Central Desert, and they had a line for me that I happened to score a goal. Mm. So when I scored my goal, I ran to the crowd like, and for me, I was running with a spear in my mind.
Yeah,
but to me, I was thinking of all of those people that I had heard the night before talking down on that moment and putting their hatred towards it. And when I ran at the crowd to throw my spear, I was throwing it at those people specifically. And I said, this is who we are.
Yeah.
This is even though I'm not First Nations, my people also. We fought back. We resisted on our lands, on our indigenous lands. You know, for me personally, as a Congo man, we actually fought the European. We were amongst the first to fight the Europeans in resistance wars, in frontier wars, and that's as early as the 1500s. So that's within me, and I mentioned last show as well, as a proud Mura man from the Amazon, you know, my people, we literally were renowned for setting colonial outposts alight, you know, so that's what I was channeling within me. And it's not to say I want to incite violence on people, but I can't erase genetic memory. And when that gets activated, there's a certain expression that comes out where our people across as original people of the planet, as black people, we carry our expression is through movement, dance. It's in our culture, you know, it comes out of us and it's the relationship that we have to time and space as being, you know, the original people of the planet. And so that's what came out of me. And I went on a little tangent there, but to bring it back was that, That was publicized, you know, that I had done that. But they also tried to hide it a little bit in the media. They didn't want to put attention on it, even though it was there. You know, I'd thrown a spear as well. So this journalist who literally for multiple years had been writing about me and he was probably the worst of them all in terms of how he was portraying me. You know, what he was portraying me, he painted a very clear public picture of me of being a problem, a troublemaker, of, you know, having mental issues and a whole range of things. And I'm talking 30 different articles spread over all of the major newspapers in Australia. That, and I actually have the meta-analysis on that. So that was the journalist who reached out to me, wanted me to contribute to his to his feature article on the Adam Goods 10-year anniversary. And it was just crazy to me. It's like, is that how? What nerve does this person have to think that 10 years later he can come up and say, oh, hey, by the way, you want to come and write in my, you know, basically what he's saying is, you give me a comment and I'll put it within the context of how I see fit. You know what I mean? And that's, to me, the logic behind that is just ridiculous to think that I would actually do that. And so, you know, it reminded me of, like, the colonizer that went and set light to your village and torched it down, and 10 years later he comes back and says, oh, do you want to write something in the brochure, you know, for the museum? That's literally that's literally what I saw it as. I'm like, it was just so that brought all of those feelings like back to the surface for me. And so I said, hang on a second, I should say something about this 10-year anniversary, especially in what was happening to Willie Rioli. But I'm not going to put it within the, I'm not going to give my voice to this journalist so he can curate what he thinks and where it should fit in. I'm going to write an open letter to black footballers in the country. And so that's what I thought. And I knew I wasn't going to be publishing it in any of the major papers, but I know how tight, you know, black people are within the country. I know it will find its way around. I know it would find its way, you know, people would see it. So that was the intention behind it. And I wanted to address, you know, four major things. One was the Adam Goods situation. The other one was, you know, what was happening with Willie Rioli, where touched on last week. But the part of that we didn't touch on was that, what he was being accused of, which is threatening players on the field. And I, you know, that's one issue where, that, again, they didn't look at in its entirety. So I wanted to touch on that. And I wanted to touch on this journalist as well, and not only from the perspective of how he painted me over the years, but of the patterns that he's following, the way that he... Because I read his piece that he wanted me to be part of, it was a big feature piece. So he had many words, like over a thousand words to write this history. But what he basically did when I analyzed it was painting. He was trying to really clean the AFL's image up, and was not being intellectually honest with his overview of that particular moment in history, and, you know, what actually happened in that time. It was basically trying to whitewash the history, which is what that's just what the culture does.
I mean, I did go and check the article out, and you're right, it doesn't really say much at all. It's just basically giving you an overview of what happened, and then the question, why won't he come back? And asking
putting it all on him. You know, he's estranged, he's scarred. And that's what one of my critiques was, hang on a second, you're using these words like estranged, like he's just, you know, disappeared. He's like, what about he's disgusted? What about instead of saying he's scarred, what about he's standing strong in his principles? In his resistance to actually the toxicity of your culture, and he doesn't want to part. It's a very different framing. You know, they like to paint us as these almost weak kind of you know, they're too hurt, they're too sensitive. Whereas no, we're standing strong because we don't want a part of what you have going on there.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's very, very different.
Yeah, it is. It is. Because the other parts of yours is also speaking out to, what was it? You know, the other good part was your threat and or warning section, which I thought great. Because, you just gave the example of, you know, in America, black Americans make up, what you said, 13%. And if something like that happened on the field there, then they'd be, their head would be on a swivel for the rest of their lives. Because that's what did you say? It's not controversial, it's a consequence. You know, because over there they have obviously a bit more power, having people, black people in media and stuff like that, whereas it's not the same here. I just loved how you just put everything together. It makes so much sense. And you're very, you've critiqued it really well as well.
It comes from you. I thank you very much for coming from you, because I read your paper and, you know, I was just, I wish I had read it before, because I would have cited it within the letter, because it goes even further. But just on what you're saying about the threat, you know, or a warning, that was a part of it. And I can talk to this because I've lived in the US for over 7 years now. My wife, she's African American. And, you know, everywhere, you know, I live in a black community. I live in South Los Angeles. So it's predominantly black and white, you know, black and brown community. Mm-hmm. And I know, because in the U.S., firstly, you know, it's a country that has 350 million people. And then 13% of that whole population is black. And then when you go into major cities like Washington DC or New Orleans or Chicago, like the percentage in the inner cities, you have some, you know, over 20%, you know, even Washington DC, I think it's like 40-41% of black people. So the point I was trying to make is that it was reported that people were consistently saying things about Willie Rioli's weight in the context, or his body shape, in the context of him eating certain foods specific to his culture. For example, turtle, right?
So that was
something that was being said to him.
Mm.
And they don't understand that, or they're willfully ignorant that how problematic that is.
Mm.
And the point I was trying to make was that if in the NBA...
Mm.
Or say the NFL, a sports where there are more, you know, majority of players are black.
Mm.
If a white player had the audacity to say to a black man, oh, look at your body shape because you're eating too much fried chicken.
Mm.
Look at your body shape because you're eating all that soul food, that cornbread.
Mm.
First of all, he like I said in the piece, he's lucky to keep his teeth. Now, I understand the black players, they respond in that way too.
Mm,
You look back at the footage of the Cracker Brothers.
Yeah.
When they were punching people's lights out, you know, and in some ways, I don't condone the violence, but I understand it because of how deep these traumas are within us, right? So there's a consequence to that. Now, I'm not condoning the violence on the field, but what I'm saying is that if that was in, say, the United States, And even like within the world sport, like world soccer, for example, that has a lot of black players.
Mm.
If a player had the audacity to say something like that to another player, then they would be warned. They would say, "Hey, if it became public, they would be told, you better be careful.
Yeah,
everywhere you go, because not to say that you're going to necessarily." Be targeted because we're telling you that we're going to target you.
Yeah.
It's more that there are consequences for that type of behavior. Mm. And when you put that out to a larger population, people are going to react to that in different ways.
Yeah, yeah.
And your safety would be in danger. So when Willie Rioli, you know, he was accused of making a threat. Now, I don't know exactly what he said, but apparently he had sent, this is what it was reported, that he had sent a message on social media to a teammate of a player and of the player that he wanted that had, if you put two and two together, a player that had obviously said something.
Yeah.
So he sent a message to the player saying, hey, look, basically you should watch out when you're in Darwin because I've got a lot of, you know, mates up there, basically. I've got a lot of people up there, which is true because he does have family and community. Mm. And you should be careful. You know, you better not. I don't know exactly what the words were because that wasn't fully reported. But the point that I was trying to make is that in one way you can look at it as a threat. In another way, you can also look at that as a warning.
Yeah.
That you've crossed the line. And if my people find out about this, which I'm close with and they're close to, and this starts to get out throughout the wider community, then there are consequences where I come from for conducting yourself in that way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was what I was trying to draw the parallel between what is just consequence for racism. And sometimes that consequence is you get retaliated against with violence.
I don't know. I was looking through YouTube the other day, and something came up. It was a player. I don't know who it was. I don't think it was Australian. And it's a photo of him punching somebody in one of the spectators. And he said, you know, oh, he called me a name first. He said, I'll let that go. But then after that, he said, I'm going to kill your wife and family. And he said, nah, that's it. He said, you don't talk about my family that way. And he just punched the guy out. So, yeah, there's always, you know, people don't know what's being thrown at players from spectators and other players as well. And they, you know, they're expected to shut up and put up, you know, shut up and not say anything or react. And you're right, I think it would be, Willie's thing, it could either be taken as a threat or a warning. Well, it is sort of a pretty big warning if you're going to go up to Darwin, especially if you've got mob up there. The thing we've covered the journalist, and it's right, the language that they use, it's very, you know, it's sad, we miss him, what a shame, that type of thing. It doesn't talk to the causalities of the reason why this person gave up the game and stuff like that too. And that's, I think, you know, it's looking at the language that's used, what's there and what's not. And then you sort of pick out, okay, I know this fella's just either whitewashing or, you know, he's trying to make it look better for this particular, you know, game or sporting. Like the AFL. So when we come to players of African descent in Australia, because there's a few more now, hey? There's a lot more. Like you said, when you started, there was like two.
When I started, there was three, and then there was two of us, and then for a long time, there was the most, throughout my career, the most there was, I think there was five or six.
Yeah.
I think that now we're the third most represented group. Within the league, there's like in the 20s now, I think.
A lot more join the game.
Yeah.
So in your letter, you talk to the players of African descent and what they need to know.
Definitely. It was, and you know, I think there's a lot of experiences that we share, you know, as people that are racialized as black.
Yeah.
You know, in Australia, we are racialized as black. We get anti-black racism and discrimination. Mm. But then obviously there's nuances in that because not all black people are the same. And we know like First Nations is very specific to the history that you've had there.
Yeah.
And for us as newer settlers, if you will, although a lot of us have refugee backgrounds because of colonialism, basically, being run off of our lands because of imperialism and colonialism and, having to be scattered around the world. Nonetheless, we are still settlers on your land, part of the settler project. And so there's definitely there's huge differences, but what connects us is the fact that we have been racialized black and get discriminated against for being black. So I wanted to speak specifically to the African players in one part of the letter because, that was my experience in the league of being a player of African descent. And, the ways that we get discriminated against there are very specific to us. And it's something that the AFL still hasn't really even acknowledged, to be honest. They haven't put any time or energy or resources towards providing adequate support. And I know you're up in the Gold Coast Suns territory and Brisbane Lions, I know, but at the Gold Coast Suns last year, a young African player, he signed the largest contract in the AFL history. For some reason, I've just had a... his name's Mac Andrews. He signed the largest contract in AFL history last year. And the AFL has literally been warned that because he's very dark-skinned, South Sudanese brother, very dark-skinned, tall. He has all of the ingredients that could make him arguably one of the most discriminated players in the history of the game. Not only would he be the most has the biggest contract, but he also, because of the lack of support within that system, he could be like the most discriminated player. And so, unfortunately, that they haven't put much in place to support this newer cohort of players that have come in. And they could have engaged myself and other people around, okay, let us learn from your experience and let's find solutions to some of these challenges that you face. But they haven't done that, and they don't that's just not a priority for them. So I wanted to speak directly to that.
Hey, it's all about the game and getting on with the game, and that's about it. Don't worry about you.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to speak directly to that, and so there's a part in the letter about that, and there's another thing in there as well that I just wanted to touch on briefly is I used the example of in the US there was a doctor in 1851 who created this sickness, this so-called mental illness called drapetomania.
Yeah.
And it was literally what they would diagnose enslaved black people who ran off the plantation. They looked at that as an actual sickness. They said, oh, there's something wrong, there's a mental disorder that these people have because they have a tendency to want to get off the plantation. Now, the same logic is being applied, and that's what I was trying to say. The same logic is being applied for black players in Adam Goode, Cyril Rioli, and myself, who no longer want to be in the AFL plantation. What I mean by that is that the conditions in the plantations were so bad that obviously people resisted that to the point where they try to escape, right? And that desire to get away from the disgusting and violent nature of that place was seen as them having a problem, them having a mental illness, them being basically with something that's pathologized.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
the same logic, it's subtle, but it's there. The same logic is being applied for the black players who no longer want to be within the AFL ecosystem.
It's
not being viewed as oh, actually, there's something wrong with our environment. It's being viewed as, oh, they're the ones that are scarred, or they're the ones that, you know, they're estranged and, you know, they're hurt. And, you know, that it's pathologizing that, not pathologizing the actual culture that they're a part of.
Oh, that was a great part of your letter. I enjoyed that a lot. And then you gave the black players a final word. So, and it's true what you wrote on the first line, you know. Some in leadership are racist, and no amount of cultural training will change that around within the thing. I love how you say, tell players to, you know, just document everything.
Yeah.
As well. What just explain what the documentation is. It's to protection, archive, and for your power as well.
Yeah. Very important.
Yeah.
Very important. Because what will happen, right, if you're a black player in any league? It doesn't matter if it's the AFL, it doesn't matter if it's NRL, doesn't matter if it's even grassroots, whether it's a country league or a state league. What will happen if you're a black player and you experience racism is the chances are you're going to be gaslit. They're going to gaslight you for calling it out. You know, you're going to become viewed as the problem. Or they will acknowledge that it's not acceptable, because depending on how blatant it is, they'll acknowledge that it's not acceptable to a certain point. And unfortunately, there's just not enough that they're prepared to do to actually address the situation, to make sure that there's accountability. And what will happen? So if it's blatant, what history shows is that they have to address it. But it's all of the, it's more of the subtle things, you know, the things that are harder to actually say, oh, this person called me a, an N-word or a black whatever, right? It's the subtle things that happen around you. And the best thing you can do is make sure you keep a document of that. You write it down and say, okay, this happened at this time. And because there will come a time where if you want to take it further, if you have that, that's going to strengthen your position. And because we're surrounded by racist systems, we need as much as we can get, because you're not going to get, you're not going to be in a system that supports you. In fact, they're going to go against, they're going to do everything to go against you and say that you're the problem. So I put that in the letter just to remind players, remind people that we still do have some power that we can exercise. And also it's a warning, because I again, going back to it, I know that even though the letter wasn't really picked up in the mainstream media, I know that mainstream people, not just in the media, but also within the AFL, would have read it. I've got, and so it's also to put them on notice as well, that, hey, you better watch it. You know, you better watch how you move, because there's black players that are going to be surveilling you, you know, putting you on it. And that, you know, so that's why.
Making you accountable. Yeah, that's actually a good idea too. Did you try NIT, National Indigenous Time?
Did I try it, or did I?
God, would you put it into the National Indigenous Time?
I would, absolutely. Yeah. I would. I just haven't been, you know, I've been very disconnected from there. And but I would love to. If you can recommend one, any contacts or anything,
I'll email
I would love
you.
To.
Yeah, I'll be emailing you.
Okay. Yeah, please send me through.
I think I do have a contact in there. And I think the other because that message has to get out all over the place, and yes, it will find its way to every community very shortly, and it, we'll put it up upload it to our website for this show too, so people can just press on a link. And now, what was the last one? Oh, okay. Lastly, we were going to yarn about the opportunities for cross-community solidarity between African and First Nations peoples. What does that look like?
Yeah. What does that look like? There's so many ways of look. In my head, and this is where my fantasy world, my imagination of the future, right? Where on the African continent, where African people have managed to kick their former colonizers, away from the domination and the exploitation out of those positions, where we as a people, as African people, have been able to mobilize and organize enough to make sure that the continent that is our homeland and the place that has the most natural resources on the planet is able to be used for us and for working class people, where we actually benefit from the abundance of the lands that we come from, right? And that trickles down through every level of our society, so we don't have to deal with extreme poverty and all of the things that comes with that. Where we're respected on the global stage. So I dream of a future where that's happening, and I think it's possible. I definitely think I have three children. I've got a 6-year-old, 3-year-old, and a 10-month-old, all boys, and I do know that when they are my age, I'm 38 now, I know that the world's going to be a completely different place because it advances in technology because of changing power structures, right? Yeah. Where we're seeing the effects of it right now, where the United States is being challenged by China. Yeah. We're seeing as well white people all over the world have mobilizing in ways around fear of their own extermination on this planet, fear of what many are calling white genocide. It's happening not just in South Africa, it's happening in the United States. They literally have a countdown, within some circles, they have a countdown on how many years it will be until they are no longer the majority in the country. I know in Australia, it's a similar thing. You just have to do a Google search, and it's been well reported that in a certain number of years, Australia will go from, the demographics is going to change, right? Yeah. And so for a critical mass of white people in the world, they're viewing this as their last chance to consolidate the power that they have. Yeah. Yeah. This is their last opportunity to hold on to something, the domination that they've had. And they're also viewing it as that there's a genocide against them, right? And so
I have heard the term, it's just, I do get it. People are a bit paranoid. Yeah. Anyway.
So I say all this to say that we're in changing times, and for the African continent and African people, Africa is the continent that has the largest, has the youngest population out of all the continents. There's a crazy statistic that by 2050, one in every four person on this planet is going to be African. And so what I'm envisioning is that the balance of power will change, and that there will be bridges that can be built between our community, our communities and our people across continents. And so I feel that on a macro level, or more of a long-term thing, is that I think it makes strategic sense for Black people all over the world to unite, because we share similar challenges, and we also have so much to share between our incredible rich cultures, you know, that come from actually us being the first people on the planet.
Yeah.
And so on a micro level, that's the biggest. So I envision a time where, you know, African people can be helping First Nations people and vice versa, right? Sharing solutions and mobilizing together and shared struggles, even though that's happened. You know, I know that there's been a lot of solidarity from First Nations folks in Australia with either against anti-apartheid or even against, you know, what's happened to the Palestinian people. Or I know that, you know, the 1960s civil rights movement, there was a lot of crossover. I know, for example, Muhammad Ali, when he went to Australia, when he touched down in Melbourne, the first place he went to, he said, "I want to know where Black people are." He went straight to Fitzroy to sit with the Parkers. He said, "I want to be with Black people." And as someone who is connected to these different places, Brazil, the United States, Congo, Angola, Australia, wherever I go, I feel at home when I'm with Black people. Yeah. I really do. I feel at home. I really do. It doesn't matter whether I'm in Buralula, which I've been, or I'm in Yundamu, or I'm in South Central Los Angeles, or here in Salvador, Brazil. There's something. There's this deep connection that I feel, and I feel that we have so much to learn and to support through our shared our shared struggles. And so this should always be, I think, a prioritization for how we can have solidarity for one another.
Yeah, that's true.
So what does that look like? You know, for me, I think education is a big part of it. You know, we need to learn about each other. I just think the more that we can connect, the better it will be for our future generations.
Yeah, I think so too, Noel, now that you can connect literally straight away with everybody. That's actually a really good vision, which we should be putting together. That's actually a really good idea.
Well, think about the way that Donald Trump, right? The way that Donald Trump has looked to South Africa and he said, the white minority there there's a genocide against them. Now that's total BS, We know that to be true. But I envision one day where Nigeria, which is a powerhouse, the largest population on the African continent, is over 200 million people in Nigeria, right? One day Nigeria being a world powerhouse and being able to look at and make those type of moves and say, hey, the way that you're exploiting Black people all over this planet can't happen anymore. So I envision things like that, you know, that kind of solidarity.
Turning everything on its head, basically.
Yes.
Looking at it from a Black point of view and a Black way of doing and knowing, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And I get what you're coming from, actually. That's a good one. Yeah. Just looking at the time. Look, over the last couple of weeks, last week and this week, we've had a absolutely so interesting conversation, yarn up with you. And I really appreciate you taking time out to come on and talk with us on the Let's Talk Black Sports show. How can Mob contact you if they want to know anything further?
Yeah, you can. I would say you could find me on social media. There's on Instagram, it's at H Lumumba. I'm sure you could put a link there on Facebook as well. My Facebook fan page, and I'm on Twitter as well, not as much. My website is lumumba.co. lumumba.co. Whenever folks reach out, mob, I always have time. Yeah. I really do. I feel, and I say this sincerely, I feel indebted to First Nations people. For me, growing up on Wadjuk Budja in, you know, so-called Perth, with the Noongar Nation, the Yamaji mob were there, the Wangai mob as well. You know, I had folks from up in Kimberley and the Pilbara that would come down to Perth, and I felt embraced my whole life. You know, when I think about my childhood, sport was a big part of it, and a big part of it was the solidarity that I felt from a very young age from the Noongar mob in particular. And I feel indebted, you know, because the freedoms that I was afforded growing up in Australia were fought through the resistance, you know, from the centuries of resistance through frontier wars and, you know, survivors of attempted extermination, you know, that pushed and fought to be recognized as human beings, that pushed and fought for civil rights, the civil rights that when I arrived in Australia in 1989, all of that groundwork had been done. So I was able to then flourish in a way that I wouldn't have if it wasn't for the blood, sweat, and tears of your people. So I feel indebted. I always will. And I feel a responsibility for me to lead a life where I never forget that. Yeah. And so, yeah, I always have time for any black fella. I will always stop to connect if I can. So,
oh, that's good, because I might connect with you about certain other things. Well, talk about, because we got a lot in common on some grounds as well, a lot of grounds, actually. No, well, look, thanks again. And, look, it was great to have a yarn with you today. I'll put up the links to, if you want to contact Heredia, they'll go up on a link after the show. So you can listen back, mob out there, you can listen back via our website, aaa.org.au, or the Community Radio App Plus app. And I'd like to thank our sponsors, Community Broadcasting Foundation and Brisbane Pride. You've been listening to AAA Murray Country. Bye.